questions about anything? So we've got an exam Friday. It's the usual sort of exam, 20 true false, 15 short answer, 5 longer questions, and you can get a pretty good idea of what's going on with it by taking a look at the exam from last year. The exam from last year for the other class is similar but not identical. I think there's probably some questions about the sun on that one that won't be appropriate for yours, but probably 90% of the 212 exam is appropriate to look at. I think, I haven't actually checked, the screencast should be sitting there. Sometimes I forget to change the protection codes, but I'm pretty sure that that should all work. We voted on help today at 4 p.m. here, and it's not going to be on the exam, but Chapter 8 is the next one we'll be covering, and maybe we'll do a little bit of that today. Questions on that sort of stuff? Okay, so what did we talk about last time? So we're kind of moving out from the stuff that we can do in the classroom to actually talk about the planets per se. And the purpose of chapter 7 and 8 are kind of give an overview of the planets. And then we'll talk about them in much greater detail. And in particular, we'll soon be moving on to the Earth, looking at its meteorology and its geology. And eventually, at the end of the semester, its biology. So in terms of the organization of the solar system, we now have 8 planets as opposed to the 9 we had when I was in grade school. We lost one, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. We've got the Pluto. We've got the inner planets, the 4 inner planets, which are called the terrestrial planets. They have rocky surfaces. They have atmospheres, but not nearly the sort of gaseous atmospheres that the other 4 planets have. And I put the M in parentheses here in that the moon is kind of an interesting example. It's not obviously a planet, it's a moon, but it's a pretty big moon, and there's a lot to learn about how planets work by looking at the moon also. The outer 4 planets, we call them gas giants. They're way bigger than the terrestrial planets. So these are all things we've looked at long ago, right? So here are the terrestrial planets kind of in perspective. And you can see that the moon is kind of a junior version of Mercury. It's worth thinking about in that same sort of context. And here we have the giant planets, Jupiter roughly 10 times bigger than the Earth, with a radically different composition. So Jupiter and the giant planets in general are made out of stuff that should seem more natural. That is to say, the stuff that most of the universe is made out of, hydrogen and helium. Whereas the rocky planets are obviously mostly made out of rock. And so kind of the first question we tried to address is, why is that the case? Why do the terrestrials have radically different compositions from the Jovian planets? That's the big difference between those guys. And the answer was that presumably there was hydrogen and helium around the Earth early on, but the Earth can't retain atoms that have that small mass. So the velocity, typical kind of velocity, there's of course a bell-shaped curve for the velocities of the atoms in this room. Some of them are moving slow, some of them are moving fast, but kind of a typical velocity depends on the temperature and the mass. And if you have a high temperature, they're moving fast. If you have a small mass, they're moving fast. And there are no atoms that have smaller masses than hydrogen and helium. So they're moving relatively fast compared to typical sort of molecules. And the escape velocity from the terrestrial planets is not particularly large. It depends on the mass of the planet and the radius of the planet, or if we can kind of put mass and radius together to get density. We're smaller planets, so we have, relatively speaking, lower escape velocities. So it turns out that if you put hydrogen or helium on Earth, it would, in a relatively short time, escape just because it's moving so fast. So it's not that hard for it to pick up the 25,000 miles an hour that's required to escape the Earth. So hot. How do we know the temperatures of the planets and what's controlling that? Well, so we derive this relationship by energy conservation. We just basically equated the power that the planets are getting from the sun to the power that they're emitting because they have a temperature, right? So everything that has a temperature is emitting energy. The walls in this room don't look like they're emitting light when we turn off the lights, but they're in fact emitting infrared radiation all the time. And I've shown you this lots of times. So this is the light that the Earth emits. So this is not looking at the bright side of the Earth. This is aiming your telescope at the dark side of the Earth. So if you looked in your eyes, you wouldn't see anything. But there's all of this infrared radiation which the Earth is shining with. So if we equate the energy that the Earth gets from the sun to the energy that it's emitting, simply because it's a hot object, we come up with this sort of relationship, which has, I think, few surprises. If the sun were hotter or bigger, the temperature on Earth would be higher. If we were closer to the sun, A is the distance we are from the sun, the semi-major axis. If we were closer, the temperature would also be hotter. The A has to do with the reflectivity of the planet. If a planet is highly reflective, it's not going to get so much of the sun's energy. So a high reflectivity is also going to reduce the temperature of the planet. And it turns out that if you do the calculation, Venus is a highly reflective planet. It has 100% cloud cover, and those clouds are highly reflective. If you do the calculation, you get a lower temperature for Venus than you do for the Earth. Emissivity is maybe the most obscure one, and it turns out that all objects don't emit light equally, and we have some measure for how emissive an object is given its temperature. Okay, so the statement that Venus is cooler than the Earth should sound crazy to you, because Venus is famous for being among the hottest planets. And so it's a matter of what temperature we're talking about. So same thing for the Earth or the Sun. They all have different temperatures as you go down. They're all much hotter in the core than they are on the surface. So the temperature we're talking about is the temperature of the surface that's emitting the light. So for Venus, that's way up in the cloud tops, and it's cool in the cloud tops of Venus. But as you go down in the atmosphere, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. It's a really dense atmosphere, so it gets very, very, very hot by the time you reach the surface. Right? Not so much for the Earth. We have a pretty big temperature difference between this calculated temperature and the temperature of the surface. But roughly speaking, our atmosphere is about a hundredth of the atmosphere of Venus. We actually started out by kind of listing off properties of planets, the extensive properties and the intensive properties. And you've all seen big tables like this, I'm sure, that show all of these numbers, which we're not really interested in at this level of detail. But all of these sorts of numbers that reflect properties that we can measure about the planets. And we divide them up into extensive properties and intensive properties. Extensive properties are one where kind of more is more, like the size of the orbit, which is the semi-major axis, as opposed to things that don't depend on the size, instead the shape, right, the eccentricity of the orbit. So one good way of making intensive things is by looking at ratios of extensive things. So mass per volume, that's the density. Temperature is the kinetic energy per particle, and the composition of the planet, the percent composition, is also an intensive variable. And then at the end, we took a look at how energy could be transferred in general. Radiation is how we're getting hot from the sun, right? Sunlight is what's heating the Earth. Convection has to do with stirring of material, hot stuff rising, cool stuff falling. And conduction has to do with energy transfer without material in motion, or at least net motion. So the spoon in the boiling water, the lip of the spoon gets hot because it's in the water, but even the end of the spoon will get hot because of conduction. And generally speaking, these planets have magnetic fields, and we commented that probably the sort of magnetic fields that you're interested in, I thought magnetic fields was on this one, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's on the other one. There's so many numbers here, it doesn't matter. Here we go, global magnetic field. You can see, generally speaking, we've got lots of yeses. We got some no's for some terrestrial planets. And it's important to recognize that those magnetic fields are not permanent magnets. They're not caused by magnetized iron like a magnet, that a horseshoe magnet that you might be used to it. They're actually electromagnets. So they have to be powered somehow. And so that's something that we'll need to discuss at some point. Questions? Okay, so let's talk more about these properties, and in particular how we would actually measure them, how we would get these sort of quantities. So for the radius of planets, the planets, unlike the stars, when we look at them through a telescope, we see a disk. The stars are so small they still look like points in the disk, and they're blurred out by the atmosphere, so we're never going to see them as disks. But for planets, we actually see them as disks, so we can measure the angle from top to bottom of those sorts of planets. And then we can use the same relationship we use for these overhead lights. You remember we said that the angle was equal to this kind of magic number, about 57, the size divided by the distance. So if we've got the angle and we've got the distance, we can calculate the physical size of the corresponding planet. Okay, so this is just surveying in order to get the radius, if I've got the distance. So how do I get the distance to the planets? Well, radar works good these days. We can bounce signals off the planets and we can get accurate to centimeters the distance to these various planets. Early on, of course, before radar, they had to use other sorts of methods, and they could still use surveying sorts of techniques. So by knowing the size of the Earth's orbit and the angle that Venus is from the Sun, we could actually calculate the size of Venus's orbit if we knew the distance that the Earth is from the Sun. And Copernicus didn't really have any idea of what that was numerically. There had been some estimates by the Greeks, but they were off by factors of 10. So early work in astronomy, a big thing was trying to get the value for the distance that the Earth is from the Sun in miles or meters or something like that. And it's called the astronomical unit. Or an AU. So we look at not in this table, about this table. These orbital radiuses in this table are being given as fractions or multiples of the Earth-Sun distance, which, as I say, is called an AU. So here we are, Earth distance of 1 AU. So how about mass? How do we weigh these planets? So remember that the trajectory of an object doesn't depend on the mass, right? So the glove that the astronauts lost has exactly the same orbit as the space shuttle that the glove was lost from. So there's nothing in the orbit that can tell us the mass of these planets. In order to measure the mass of these planets, we have to have something that's orbiting around it, because then we can see the force that's pulling the moon around in its orbit, and we can calculate what the corresponding mass was. So you might remember we showed the relationship that the orbital speed, basically what we did is we equated the force of gravity to the acceleration, which you remember was a centripetal acceleration. So lots of things canceled out. So if we see the speed or how long it takes for a planet to go around, we can calculate the mass of the corresponding object. So Pluto's kind of a special case. When it was discovered, we didn't see any moons around it, so for a long period of time, we had kind of just bad guesses about what the mass of Pluto was. So, maybe 30 years ago, Charon, the big moon, it has two other moons too, the big moon of Pluto was discovered, and then we could accurately measure the mass of Pluto and see that it's a pretty small, pretty low mass object. So similarly, Mercury's mass is a little bit uncertain. We now have a space probe that's around Mercury, but before that we had ones that went past it. And just going past a planet, just enough to see the deflection is enough to calculate the mass of the planet. So with the exception of Pluto, the masses of the planets have been known pretty accurately since, say, 1970 or something like that. But we have to have something that's being affected by the planet in order to get its mass accurately. Otherwise, it's just some sort of guesstimate that might be based on the density. Well, if we've got the mass and we've got the radius, we can calculate the density of these guys. And you remember the kind of important factoid that the big difference between the gas giant planets, I'd go so far as to say the defining difference between the gas giants and the terrestrial planets is their density. Kind of no surprise, if you're made out of gas, you're going to have a lower density than the terrestrial planets. So here we've got the terrestrial planets, including the moon, densities of about 5 times that of water. Here we have the gas giant planets. Remember, in these units, water is about 1,000. So we have Saturn that would float if there were a bathtub big enough. It has a density that's less than that of water. But these things are all more or less comparable to the density of water. That in itself may surprise you, right? Gas having a density of water, well, it's highly compressed gas. Huge planets, huge pressures, huge compositions. Eccentricity, of course, Kepler was the guy who figured out the eccentricities of the planets. It basically just takes surveying techniques in order to figure out what the shape of the orbit is. Composition. So I think pretty logically, early on people thought that it was going to be impossible to figure out the composition of the planets. And you remember that Aristotle thought the composition was radically different from what it is on Earth, right? The quintessence, the fifth element. These days we've had space probes that have actually landed on a lot of these planets, or at least gone by them, so they've sampled the composition pretty directly. But the composition was pretty well established before the space probes actually went to visit. And the way to do that is, of course, is by looking at the spectra. So you remember that, for example, for the sun, we've got all of these absorption lines. Those absorption lines are characteristic of the corresponding material. The strength of the line depends on the concentration of the material. So we can figure out the composition of these planets by looking at the spectra. So a moment ago, we were looking at the spectra of the Earth. And you can see, again, so this is light that's not particularly from the surface of the Earth. So we're not seeing rock here. We're seeing stuff that's in the atmosphere. So we can see carbon dioxide and water and ozone as absorption lines in the Earth spectra. So similarly, we can look at the spectra of the other planets and we can figure out what their composition is. Now there's one kind of big problem here, and it's immediately evident in this spectra, because these things are not mostly what the atmosphere is made out of. The atmosphere is not mostly made out of ozone. It's not mostly made out of carbon dioxide. The three principal elements in the Earth's atmosphere are nitrogen and oxygen and argon. Everything else is relatively small change. So where are nitrogen, oxygen, and argon on this graph? Why don't we see it? And the answer is a little bit subtle and maybe a little bit hard to understand. You remember, in order to produce light, you had to have accelerating charge. And these guys are symmetric molecules. So if they vibrate, there's no change in the overall charge density. And so vibrating homonuclear diatomics, complicated word. Homo meaning the same nucleus, diatomic, two atoms. So things like H2 and of course N2 and O2, chlorine, diatomic molecules where the nuclei are the same, they're not going to have a corresponding peak in these spectra. Because when they vibrate symmetrically, and symmetrical vibrations aren't going to be producing or absorbing light. So something like carbon dioxide, it's not a homonuclear diatomic big peak. Ozone, O3, not a homonuclear diatomic big peak. Water, present. So we're in kind of a funny state with our atmosphere in that the primary, I haven't talked about argon, but I'll come to it in a minute. The primary constituents of our atmosphere, in fact, don't make a big impact in terms of their absorption spectra. And the same is true of the gas giant atmospheres. It's actually pretty hard to get that sort of data. So a word about the so-called inert gases. So argon and helium and neon, if you remember your periodic table from high school, they're on the far right-hand corner, and they're chemically inert, and they pretty much only exist in this monoatomic state, and there's nothing to vibrate. So they can have electronic transitions, but those are going to be at much higher energies, in particular ultraviolet light. And so we're not going to see them on this sort of graph, which is actually infrared light. So it's actually pretty hard to figure out the quantities of diatomic, homonuclear diatomics, or inert gases in the atmospheres of these planets. So people still argue about how much helium there is in Saturn. It turns out to be a relatively hard measurement to make. But theoretically, things are easy. If you see the absorption lines, you should be able to calculate the corresponding composition. It's just that the homonuclear diatomics and the inert gases don't produce absorption lines in the part of the spectra that we can actually see the light from. And incidentally, the same thing applies to the sun. It's a non-trivial observation to realize that the sun is mostly hydrogen and helium. Before 1900, people didn't think that. They actually thought that the sun was mostly iron, basically because iron has lots of absorption lines in the sun's spectra. Okay. Now, there's another complication that's maybe worth talking about, and that has to do with solids as opposed to gases. So for gases, the atoms are isolated and they don't interact with their neighbors because their neighbors are way far away, relatively speaking. If we have a solid, then we have atoms that are cheek to jowl. And so they're going to affect each other quite a bit. So instead of the energy levels being a definite size and therefore a definite energy jump, with neighbors around, exactly where this orbit is will change depending upon exactly where the neighbors are. So instead of getting a crisp line, we get broad sorts of peaks. So here are attempts to figure out the composition of, I guess something I haven't talked about, various asteroids. So this is what the spectra looks of these asteroids, and they're not nearly as so definitive as the graphs that we were looking at for the Earth. That's because what we're looking at here are solid surfaces, and for solid surfaces, we don't get really crisp lines, we get these broad sort of peaks. So figuring out what the composition of Vesta is a little bit difficult. Now, as a matter of fact, we currently have a spacecraft that's orbiting around Vesta, and it's using nuclear methods in order to get the surface composition of Vesta. But previously, what we would do is we would kind of match up rocks that we could pick up from space, meteorites, and we could say, this rock that we picked up in space has a pretty similar reflection spectra to what Vesta has, so probably they have pretty much the same composition, and this guy we can pick up and put in our laboratories and figure out what the chemical composition is. But chemical composition of solids is not so definitive as of gases. You can imagine that this is well, look at the stony irons. There isn't much to be really prominent in this spectra to really be convinced that, you know, say that one corresponds to that one. So solids, it's a little bit trickier than it is with gases. And solids are going to be mostly relevant when we're talking about asteroids. So I guess having brought that up, I should talk a little bit about the minor constituents in the solar system. So you know that, I don't know, what I was told in grade school, which is wrong, is that the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars is a planet that was broken apart. Not true. But what we have are lots of rocks, generally speaking, pretty small rocks. There's not nearly enough mass here to make a reasonably sized planet. What we have here is bunches of rocks that seem to be mostly concentrated between Jupiter and Mars. There certainly are asteroids that are every place else too, but there are way more of them in this particular region. In the same sort of sense, it's not on this graph particularly, but beyond the orbit of Neptune, there are also a bunch of rocks. And actually, at this point, they're more icebergs than they are rocks. And that's called the Kuiper Belt. So in addition to planets, we've got lots of small stuff too. And some of these small things are big enough to be called dwarf planets. So on this list of dwarf planets, Sirius is, and that's where the spacecraft that's currently around Vesta is going to next. It's one of these that's in the asteroid belt. The other guys on this chart, Makemake, Eris, and I guess I'm not sure how to pronounce this guy, those are all in the Kuiper Belt, as is Pluto. So these guys are all these days called Kuiper Belt objects. I should probably spell Kuiper because it's not the way you might think. Okay, so asteroids, planets. The other minor object that is we're spending a little bit of time on are comets. So a comet, the kind of some approximation, is just a icy asteroid that happens to have an orbit that brings it close to the sun. So when it gets close to the sun, that ice will evaporate and we'll get these material that has been ablated off the surface of the comet. The comet rock itself is pretty small, kilometers in scale, but the gas that's being ejected is going to be sometimes millions of miles long, and hence is visible in the sky. Now, it's important to recognize sometimes there's confusion about how comets work. So comets are more or less like planets. They're not going to go zooming across the sky. They're going to rise in the east and set in the west, just like the planets do. And their position day to day is probably not going to change, you know, more than a fraction of a constellation per day. And even though these things are present all the time, they're only going to, usually all that we could see is this tiny nucleus, and that's not going to be visible to the naked eye. So the only time we can see them is when they're relatively close to the sun, so they're in this process of outgassing. Now, one of the minor mysteries involved in this is we can calculate how much stuff is coming off of a comet every time it closes approach to the sun, and it turns out that it's tens of meters. And if this thing is only a kilometer in size, there are only so many close approaches it can make before it's going to disappear into nothing. So these things probably only make 100, 1,000 close approaches to the sun before they totally evaporate. So why are they still here, right? So something like Halley's Comet has a period that's a fraction of 100 years. So if it goes around 100 times, it should only survive for 10,000 years. But the solar system is about 4.6 billion years old. So how is it that this comet that could only survive 10,000 years in the future is still here? And the answer is it's probably only recently gotten into this orbit. Surrounding the solar system, we have a cloud of comet nuclei. It's called the Oort cloud. So this is typically beyond the Kuiper belt that we're talking about before. So way out from the sun, good fraction of the distance to stars, we have, you know, kind of this cloud of comet nuclei that are left over from the formation of the solar system. And usually they're going to stay orbiting out here at great distances, taking millions of years in order to complete their orbits. But occasionally perturbations, they come close to another comet, can change their orbit so that they start to go crashing into the inner parts of the solar system. And then they have a limited lifetime, 100 or 1,000 transits near the sun before they will totally evaporate. So we've got this storage closet of comets that is very gradually being used up when they end up coming crashing by the sun. Questions? So that's kind of it for our inventory of the solar system. You can kind of draw a line through your notes, and we're go on and talk about stuff that's kind of in chapter 8. But that inventory of the solar system is where we'll call it quits in terms of the test. Well, kind of two possible starting points. And one is how did the solar system form? And the other interesting starting point, I think, is this number that I claimed to know, when it formed. Right? And the answer being 4.6 billion years ago. There's no real reason to be highly concerned about this decimal plate because it takes 100 million years or a couple hundred million years in order for the solar system to form. So 4.6, 4.5, it all depends on exactly when you think it has formed. So the overall idea of how the solar system formed is if we look with our telescopes out in space, we see that space isn't empty. There are big gas clouds. And the biggest of these are called giant molecular clouds. And this word clouds is maybe an overstatement because they're way less dense than the clouds that we have in our atmosphere. So they're very, by the standards of Earth, these things would just be vacuum. But there are molecules there and they're huge in extent, maybe 100 light years in diameter. And what we see in these giant molecular clouds is there are regions that have even higher density, and it sure seems that what's happening is those high density regions have a gravitational pull and they're attracting material to it. So we see cases in these giant molecular clouds where we have stars that are in the process of formation. So-called protostars. So the sun started as a piece of one of these giant molecular clouds that started to collapse basically because there was an overdensity at some particular spot. And so the attractive force of that mass for this gas was outweighing the thermal velocity that these things have simply because they have a temperature. So the atoms, instead of escaping that collapsing area, were actually accreting to that star. Now, the size of this patch that we're talking about is several light years in diameter. So it's not a small thing at this point, the size of the solar system. It's comparable to the distance between the stars. And there probably isn't any obvious non-random motion. That is to say, this cloud, just like clouds on Earth, has various pieces of it that are slowly going in different directions. But remember the ice skater effect. a very slow random velocity a light year away, as the stuff starts to accrete, it's going to automatically spin up because of the ice skater effect, because of conservation of angular momentum. Right. So we start with our this cloud with stuff at great distances from the center. As it gets pulled in, it automatically is going to spin faster and faster and faster. So what started as kind of a random lump is going to end up as a disk. And it's kind of hard for me to draw on the board, but you can imagine that there's a growing sun, and around it there would be a disk of material. Let me draw a side view of it here. So here's the sun, and we have material that is in the process of slowly spiraling in to the sun. And it's this nebula of material from which the planets are going to form. And it should be pretty clear that very close to the sun it's going to be hot, and very far from the sun it's going to be cool. So the only place we're going to have ice condense as icebergs is going to be at great distances from the sun. So what we're going to have close to the sun are going to be things that only melt at high temperature, right? Rocks. Whereas further out, we can have things like icebergs in addition to the rocks and a lot of gas. And we think that that difference between what's condensing where in the solar nebula has to do with what the differences are in the compositions, in addition to the escape velocity that we mentioned before. So it's only out there that the temperatures are cold enough to condense these icy materials. And I think I said before that this word ice, I mean to include not just water, but methane and ammonia. Anything that has a condensation temperature that is moderately cool, in contrast to things that are really gases like hydrogen and helium that only condense at very low temperature. And I guess just to be moderately complete, we've got rock, which is mostly silicon oxide, and then we have metals like iron. Symbol for iron is Fe, unfortunately. Like iron and nickel, copper, all of those sorts of things. Okay, so the planets built up then from those rocks that are orbiting around the proto-sun, kind of piece by piece by piece. And the exact mechanism is less than perfectly clear. The book talks about two possibilities. You might have your money on some unknown third possibility just as well, because it's really pretty tricky. I mean, when you throw a snowball at a snowball, they don't usually stick together to make a bigger snowball, right? Usually they just shatter each other. Now, there is going to be a gravitational force that's going to pull the stuff back together, but for small snowballs, the gravitational force is negligible. So exactly how we build up from these small things to these bigger things depends on how exactly things stick together, and it's less than perfectly clear how exactly that happens. But the overall picture we're really confident of, because we can see solar systems in formation around other stars. We see dust disks. We see exactly the sort of process going on. Now, we can't literally see planets in the process of creation, because again, that takes hundreds of millions of years. So we have to wait 100 million years before we see planets in the process of formation. But again, particularly in chapter 8, we're going to be talking about lots of planets around other stars. So at this point, I don't know whether you've heard this or not, we've got the 8 planets in our solar system, but we've got 800 planets around other stars that have been detected, say, in the last 10 years. And yeah, the number always increases, kind of depends on what you want to count as a detection. But approaching 1,000, maybe 2,000 planets around other stars. So there seems to be nothing unusual about having planets produced as a part of the star formation process. But the details are not clear. So maybe I'll just comment briefly on what the book talks about for formation, about the giant planets. And they're kind of two possibilities, and it's basically whether the rock comes first or the gas comes first. So out here in the cold, we can imagine getting conglomerations of basically gas that then start the process of attracting other stuff to it. Or the process that we think has to be the case for the terrestrial planets, that it's the rocks that get together and somehow stick together and then attract other stuff to it. Okay, questions? So that's, you know, a thumbnail sketch of how we think things form. And it's not written in stone, I guess that's what I want to say. The more we learn about these other planetary systems, the less sure we are about how ours are formed. So if you were to go read a document that's, say, 15 years old, they would say definite things about how solar systems formed that we know are now definitely wrong. How do we get this date? Well, so we need, in order to get an accurate time, we need some sort of clock that has to be present in the rocks. And what we've got going for us is radioactive decay. And we talked very briefly about this in the past. So it turns out if you have a neutron that is just sitting around that isn't part of a nucleus, which of course it's made out of two down quarks and an up quark, and you just wait about 1,000 seconds, it turns out that what happens is one of these down quarks becomes an up quark, and in the process it releases an electron and a neutrino. So we end up then with a proton. So a neutron can become a proton plus an electron and a neutrino spontaneously. And that's for a free neutron, but the same process can happen for some neutrons that are part of a complicated nucleus, right? So we have lots of neutrons and protons all stuck together in a particular nucleus, and this same process can go. Incidentally, the reverse process can also go inside nuclei. That is to say, we can have a proton that becomes a neutron, and in the process emits an antimatter electron and a neutrino. So an antimatter electron is just like an electron, except it has the opposite charge. And if matter meets antimatter, if you watch Star Trek, you know, they mutually annihilate. Historically, antimatter was first discovered in the 30s, so it's at this point a very well-established process. You can't buy a bottle of antimatter because it would be hard to ship, but they actually have stored antimatter very carefully for months, but not large amounts of it. I guess that was the basis of one of those movies, right? CERN was collecting antimatter. I can't remember the details. CERN has been in the process of destroying the world lots of times in movie worlds. So this process is surprising in that, first of all, it's not like chicken eggs, right? So with an egg, it's going to hatch in a given number of days, right? So for human babies, 9 months, you don't have to worry about that baby being at term for 18 months. It just doesn't happen, right? Or 2 months. Those things have kind of a definite time scale. And for radioactive decay, that's not how it works. So for any given century, there's a certain probability of it decaying. And if it doesn't decay in that century, it's exactly the same chance for the next century, and the century after that, and the century after that, and the century after that. So it's always more kind of like rolling dice, right? So if you didn't get a six the first time, it doesn't change the chance of getting a six the next time. And people have gone to extraordinary extents to see if there's any way of changing the rate at which radioactive stuff decays. Right? That would be a great way of getting energy. If you could take stuff that is stable and somehow magically make it decay and release all its energy and then make it not decay and put it back in the ground and have it be perfectly safe. But as far as we can see, there's nothing that can affect this rate. People have worked really hard. I could put a little asterisk about that, but for subtle reasons, occasionally, for the right process, you can have effects of extraordinary high density on rate. But aside from those minor footnotes, nothing affects the rate of radioactive decay. So if we look at something like carbon-14, right. So again, because this is carbon, it's got 6 protons. And because this is 14, 6 minus 14 is 8, it's got 8 neutrons. And it's not like garden variety carbon. Most carbon is carbon-12, which has 6 neutrons and 6 protons. Carbon-13 is not particularly uncommon, and it's stable. But what happens for carbon-14, if you wait about 5,000 years, it spontaneously decays into, what's happening is one of these neutrons becomes a proton, it spontaneously decays into nitrogen-14 and then gives off an antimatter electron and a neutrino. So if you have an old piece of wood that's been sitting around for a long period of time, it'll have less carbon-14 in it than a piece of wood that was just grown. If it's 5,000 years old, it'll have half the amount of carbon-14 that the recently grown piece of wood has. So by looking at what fraction of the carbon-14 is still there, you can get an idea of when that wood was first grown. Now this should beg some funny questions, right? Why is there any left? If the whole shebang is 5 billion years old and it decays 50-50 in 5,000 years, it should be 100% used up basically by now. So the answer is carbon-14 is continuously created in the Earth's atmosphere by processes that we don't control, so-called cosmic rays. So the Earth and the universe is being constantly bombarded by high-speed particles. And those high-speed particles, when they run into a nitrogen in the Earth's atmosphere, they can do the reverse reaction. They can make carbon-14 out of nitrogen-14. So this process is constantly going on. So the cause of it is cosmic in scope, so it's not something that changes in time. So we have a constant amount of carbon-14 in our atmosphere. And for any living thing, it's going to be in equilibrium with the carbon that's in the atmosphere. Everything that's alive currently has the same amount of carbon-14 in it. So when you die and you stop eating new carbon, then what you have is going to gradually decay. And the amount you have left is just going to depend on how long it's been since you've been dead. So carbon-14 is great for measuring human artifacts, right, which have that sort of time scale, thousands of years. But if we're going to measure the age of the Earth, we need something that has a much longer time scale. And there are lots of these sorts of things out there. Uranium-235 is one. But there are lots of these things that have half-lives that are measured in billions of years. And we can do the same process with them, except those things aren't being continually recreated. Whatever the original inventory of uranium-235 was in the Earth, it's being gradually used up. So if we look at the fraction of that that's in a rock, we can figure out when that rock was last molten. Okay, so then it's a matter of finding the oldest rock. And then you claim that the oldest rock is when the whole shebang started. So if you look around at kind of a typical spot on the Earth, a typical sort of rock is going to turn out to have be on the order of 100 million years old. Most of the surface of the Earth is relatively young. If you go to northern Minnesota, it's no problem to pick up rocks that will date at 2 billion years old. This is the old continental region of that dates back to very early times. So about the oldest rocks that people have found on Earth are a little bit more, not as old as 4.5 billion years old, but a little bit more than 4 billion years old. So what are the oldest rocks that we find? Well, they're not rocks from Earth. They're meteors. So we have these rocks that are plunging to Earth through the Earth's atmosphere. They make the little streak in the sky. Okay. Some technical vocabulary again, that's probably not necessary. Meteor. So a meteor is not a rock in your hand. Technically speaking, a meteor is the flash in the sky. So you can't hold a meteor in your hand. You can hold a meteorite in your hand. That's the rock before it hits the Earth, or excuse me, after it hits the Earth. The meteoroid is what it was when it was flying through space. Okay, I don't really care about those distinctions, but they are there. Technically speaking, a meteor is the flash. Meteorite is the rock that you can pick up in your hand, and the meteoroid is one you might be able to pick up if you went out in space, because that's where they're flying around. So, again, historically, the existence of meteors was a real problem for Aristotle. So first of all, rocks falling from space, there aren't rocks up there, right? There's only the quintessence. And there's not supposed to be any change up there anyway. So you might notice that this word meteor is a lot like meteorology, the study of the Earth's atmosphere. And it, I guess it's in some sense appropriate because it is the flash of light. But that's what Aristotle thought, that these things were all earthly phenomena. They had nothing to do with outer space. And the unusual black rocks that people found certainly were not made of quintessence, so they had nothing to do with falling from space. And you know, it's pretty rare to actually see a rock that falls from space. There are lots of cases these days where cars have been hit. I think one person has been hit. I think a cow was killed by a meteorite. It's all pretty rare. So you could pretend at least that there weren't rocks falling from space. But by circa 1800, it was pretty clear that there were rocks falling from space. And so another sense in which Aristotle was wrong. So if we look at these meteorites, they come in various flavors. So we've got, I guess I don't see, the meteorites that you probably see in museums are iron. And they typically look like black iron. They might have some flow features that come from them being heated to incandescence when they went through the Earth's atmosphere. These guys are actually pretty rare. The only reason they're in, well, they're in museums, I guess, in part because they're rare, but they're also unusual. So they're easy to see that they're something that is not at all normal. It turns out that much more common sorts of meteorites are just look more or less like stones. And the way we can figure out that they are actually not from this planet has to do with looking at their isotopic ratios. And it turns out that if you're in space for a period of time, you get radioactive stuff from the same cosmic rays hitting you that you wouldn't get if you were sitting on the surface of the Earth. So kind of through careful analysis, we can see that some of these things that look like Earth rocks are not, in fact, Earth rocks. And then we have the carbonaceous ones. And these look, so pretty commonly somebody will bring in a piece of macadam and they'll ask you if that's a meteorite. And the answer is it looks a whole lot like these carbonaceous meteorites, but almost all of them are pieces of macadam as opposed to things that fell from space. So these things are very dark and have lots of carbon in them, hence the name. So the fact that we have relatively meltable stuff like carbon that has survived, these things have probably been kind of in cold storage for a long time. They haven't been close to the sun. The ones that are iron, they probably were inside very large asteroids that were then broken apart out in the asteroid belt. It's pretty unusual to have iron, pure iron in any earth rock, although the banded iron formation up north is kind of a counterexample to this. So carbonaceous chondrites turn out to be the oldest rocks that we can find. So a subcategory of these carbonaceous rocks have little, what are called chondrules, little kind of pea-sized indentations in them that look like pieces of rock that were melted and then quickly resolidified in space because they're spherical droplets. They're not droplets that have fallen. And those are the guys that date back to this 4.5 billion years ago. But we see everything in between, including, as I say, typical Earth rocks, maybe more like 100 million years. Okay, so radioactive dating provides the way that we can tell when a rock was last molten. And it's based on this process that is really disconnected from anything that we can affect, radioactive decay, which is in turn, you might remember, caused by the weak force. Okay. I think I don't want to get too far, I don't think it helps to get too far ahead of where we're going to be for the exam. So I'm going to talk more generally about what the future is as opposed to trying to cover real material. So what I've said is kind of what comes next is looking at the Earth because it's the planet that we know the best. And typically we've divided up our study of Earth into these subdisciplines. So we've got geology, which is mostly interested in the rocks, how they happen to form. And we've got meteorology. So that's dealing with the atmosphere. And we've got biology, which is dealing with the living part of the Earth. Now, in the context of this course, biology is, in some sense, the least interesting part. Because as far as we can tell, this is the only planet that has life. And if there is life someplace else, it's probably nothing like what life is on this planet. So we're going to delay talking about biology until the very end of this course, if we get to it. So we're mostly going to be thinking about how the rocks formed on this planet and how the atmosphere works in this planet. And almost immediately, we're going to be doing vocabulary again. So we're going to be dividing up these areas into their subdisciplines. So they're going to be pieces of the inside of the Earth that we're going to be studying and pieces of the Earth's atmosphere that we're going to be studying and how those things work. So in terms of geology, there's been kind of a revolution in geology that dates back to about 1950. And that is, if you go look at the historical geologists, they're of course trying to figure out how the rocks formed, but the implication of what they're working on is that the rocks have always been there, so that the latitude and longitude of these rocks was an invariant with respect to time. In about 1950, people, 1950, 1960, people started to believe that that wasn't the case, that just because a rock was found at a latitude of 45 degrees didn't mean it was deposited at a latitude of 45 degrees, that the whole shebang may be in motion. So this goes under the name of continental drift. And the original evidence for it, which wasn't believed and goes back to the early part of the 1900s, is just if you try and fit together the African continent and South America, they kind of fit. And not only do they roughly fit together, if you look at rocks that are there, they're very similar to rocks that are there. But, you know, similarity isn't what's required in order to do in order to prove this sort of relationship, that things are actually in motion. And of course the question is going to be, why are they moving? And the answer has to be deep inside the Earth. Something has to be pushing those continents around. So, I mean, how can we learn about what's going on in the Earth, right? I look down and all I see is carpet. I don't see inside the Earth. So, how can we actually see these layers that are inside the Earth and how they in fact work? And I think we already answered that question. We need some sort of wave that the Earth isn't opaque to, right? So the Earth is opaque to light, can't see very far using light. One wave that the Earth is pretty transparent to is sound. So instead of looking with light, if we look with sound waves, seismic measurements, we can get ideas about what the internal structure is of the Earth. But the basic pattern is clear, was clear even before people started to literally look inside the Earth, and that is we expect that the heavy stuff, the dense stuff, is going to go to the center and the light stuff is going to be floating on top. So very early on, people figured out that there was probably a lot of iron and dense rock in the core, and what we live on is just kind of the light junk that has come to the surface when the whole planet differentiated. So differentiation of planets is basically just the heavy stuff sinking and the light stuff, typically silicate rocks, they're going to come to the surface. And this process doesn't really demand that that these things be liquid, although we think that that was the case in the early Earth. If you just, you know, throw pennies into your cat litter box and shake it around, the pennies are going to end up on the bottom of the litter box, even though everything's nicely made out of solid sort of stuff. So the overall structure of all of the planets and the sun and pretty much everything is where we have differentiation, where the heavy stuff, which typically means iron, has sunk to the center, and the lighter stuff is floating on top. So if we look at these pictures of the Jovian planets, we've always commented on how these are gas giants. But here you can see they're all built around a core that is rock and iron and metal. Now again, you shouldn't be thinking about these things as being solid. The temperatures at the center of Jupiter are way too hot for iron or rock or metal to be in solid form. So what we have here is a very high temperature, liquid if you want to say, gaseous if you want to say, high density stuff. And we have the lower density stuff like the hydrogen gas sitting on top of metallic hydrogen, sitting on top of ices, forming the core of these sorts of planets. Okay, so differentiation is simply the process that the heavy stuff sinks and the light stuff comes to the surface. Okay, so with that kind of thumbnail sketch, we'll come back and pick up, I don't know, either meteorology or geology. It kind of depends what I'm thinking about on Tuesday.